Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 390th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada.
And Mike, as you know, we tend to try to publish things on occasion.
Some of us do.
Yes, yes. You know, it may just be children's books, but
you'd be lucky to get in there.
Oh yeah, yeah. One fish, two fish, black fish, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, how that goes. So about a month ago, I published sort of an editorial, if you will, with a fellow named Glenn Elwin, who is with the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice in Lebanon, New Hampshire, United States of America.
And I thought Glenn Elwin was an elf in The Two Towers.
Oh, he is. It's that guy. No.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, but no, Glenn is a really a very strong component proponent, if you will, of doing, you know, shared decisions, and how do you do that in real life practice? So we're on a sort of a listserv, and I'd sent out some information about or talked about shared decision making. He got back to me and we got chatting about things, and we said, you know, we should write an editorial on this, and so that's what we did. It took us about a year to get it published, but we, you know what it's like trying to get stuff published. But we finally got it published in BMJ Evidence-Based Medicine. And we thought what we'd do for this podcast is sort of go over some of the concepts of what we were trying to get across. And Mike, I know you can add your 2, 3, 5 cents worth as we go along.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, James, now you, we work together almost every week.
Yes.
But I'm looking here and I don't see my name in here or in the small print.
That's weird. I think you need glasses because in very small print, it's at the end and it says,
we
would like to not acknowledge Mike Allen because he was of no value whatsoever.
No help. That is true. It would have been preposterous for me to be a go-on because you and Glenn did this all by yourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
So was just my little dig.
Yeah, yeah, and a little tear. Yeah. So the title of the article was "Shared Decision is the Only Outcome That Matters When It Comes to Evaluating Evidence-Based Practice." And we wanted to put out this to be a little bit provocative. And I think that the concepts come from the fact that, you know, when we're talking about shared decision or when we're talking about population health outcomes, as you know, when you talk about, you know, blood pressure, cholesterol, and glucose and all that, people rarely take into account values and preferences when we're talking about, you know, the global treatment of these things. I think you'd probably agree with that, eh?
Rarely as defined as almost never, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to, you know, give a little bit of opportunity that there might be people discussing it. But no, in general, the population health outcomes really are saying, well, you know, we need this threshold for blood pressure and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
and exactly. We've talked about this in the past where we've actually looked at guidelines for not just sort of the cholesterol and blood pressure things, but many guidelines don't take into account values and preferences. Or if they do, they just mention it with a line, sort of a throwaway line.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sort of the paradigm of the issue that we wanted to sort of talk about was we think that there's the focus of how we evaluate evidence-based practices is incorrect. And we call it a frame shift error. And that was not me coming up with that. That was Glenn. He's the brains behind most of the writing of this.
I think anyone who knew both of you would assume that.
Yes, no, exactly. Thank you. It's so much fun doing the podcast with you. Yeah. And so our key feature, which is based on the title, is that we suggest that the key outcome for evidence-based practice evaluation should be primarily, if not exclusively, focused on shared decision-making. And we sort of came up with that because the concept of evidence-based medicine has been around since, I think, about 1992. I think that was the first time it sort of came out, or the concept of the philosophy. And we now sort of talk about it as evidence-based practice, if you will. And you've read a lot of stuff about evidence-based medicine, I know, Mike, and over, you know, in the mid-1990s and even just recently, there's been a, you know, a lot of discussion about that there's a problem with evidence-based, you know, what it is and what it isn't, and is evidence-based medicine a movement in crisis? And,
yes,
you know, a lot of people have written about that sort of stuff. And they talk about how evidence-based practice has been misappropriated and distorted by vested interests. And it has. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say that this is evidence-based, or this is, you know, based on evidence and so on. And often it isn't. And it's really interesting, even when you talk to people and they say, well, this is an evidence-based statement, or this is based on evidence, you always have to ask them, well, what do you mean by that, right?
Well, usually it's they've looked at a website or two.
Yeah.
And that's good evidence. Or I mean, this is a chronic problem for us, and we see this with guidelines and people talking about guidelines, and you and I both know have had discussions where people feel guidelines are the focus of evidence-based practice.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it drives us both a bit crazy. And you've also often heard I haven't heard it in the last, you know, few years, but certainly back, you know, 10 years ago, people would say, well, is there any evidence that doing evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practice improves outcomes? I'm sure you remember hearing those, or people actually wrote articles about it.
Yeah, I don't. That's an interesting question, right? Because mm-hmm. how do you, if you took, for example, where it all started, really where we started to really have kind of a reflection of what we're doing and that kind of thing was with the antiarrhythmics. Mm-hmm. And how they were causing more people to die, even though we were prescribing them for people who are having a lot of extra beats and that kind of thing. And so what would you do? How do you then determine, now that we're not using antiarrhythmics anymore, or certainly not at the same level, how do you assess that? Mm-hmm. Because if you take the best available evidence, we knew that that was harming people. It was, I think, killing about one in every 20. Mm-hmm. And now that we're not doing that, how do you verify that that is the case still, right?
Yeah.
Do we put people on antiarrhythmics, or like, what do we do? How do we prove it? So it's a great question, because and I've also heard people belittle evidence-based medicine because they'll say, we don't need RCTs for everything. For example, we don't need, like, should we have RCTs about jumping out of a plane without a parachute on?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And it takes it to the absurd, because mm-hmm. You don't need RCTs when you have an all or nothing end point,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And evidence-based practice is not about RCTs.
No.
You know, and that's the misnomer that a lot of people come up with. But I know I've also been, involved in people who, sort of talk about trying to get grants to do evidence-based practice things, and often they'll say, well, what outcomes are you going to look for? You can't do a study without outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, so what is the appropriate outcome? Because, you know, a lot of people say, well, we should try to get as many people on evidence-based
therapies
as much as possible. That almost flies in the face of the concept of evidence-based practice.
It avoids the evidence-based practice, as originally defined, is P, right?
Yes.
Patients, evidence, and experience, or patients' experience and evidence. And the patients are obviously a key part of that.
Yeah.
And it's to do with their values and preferences. So, that is the point of evidence-based practice. It's often missed. People focus just on the research side of it, but actually it's...
And you kind of get, I've seen sort of in sort of the heart failure or post-MI studies where they've attempted to get as many people on beta blockers or ACE inhibitors and so on. And that is a form of evidence-based practice, but it's not really. It's sort of getting people on therapies which have been proven to work.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad, I'm not saying, I'm not arguing that that's a bad idea. I mean, it's much better than the reverse of that, which is trying to make sure people on medications or treatments that don't work.
I'm taking notes now.
Yes, yeah. Well, although, there's a lot of stuff that we still do that doesn't work, but we tend to do it. But that's a whole other talk. So the premise again of our article was to talk about, well, I don't think it's essential that just because you are doing evidence-based practice, it doesn't actually mean that you will actually get better clinical outcomes. That's not actually the whole concept in my mind of what evidence-based practice is. It would be great if it did, because why would we want worse outcomes? But you know, it may not be the case, and I'm going to talk about an example of where that comes into how we could actually have worse outcomes by actually doing evidence-based practice. Now, hopefully that is not a consistent thing, but you could sort of argue that it's not about the, do you have less MIs or strokes or even improved quality of life, because you do have to take into account values and preferences. And that's sort of the concept that we're trying to get across.
All right.
So, and as you know, many sort of clinical practice guidelines profess to be based on evidence-based practice concepts when they really don't. I think, you know, we need studies that look at population interventions, because it's the only way we can ever figure out if statins or blood pressure lowering works. But then you got to shift it around to go, okay, now what do we do with the individual patient and how do we do that? Because one of the things we talk about in this article is we talk about what evidence-based practice is not. And we've got a kind of a cool, I think, infographic, if you will, in this document to talk about what it isn't. And some of the things that we talked about that evidence-based practice is not, it's not about following guidelines. I think you'd probably agree with that, eh, Mike?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And it's not about checkbox medicine. It's not by going, oh, making sure. Now, there are certain things that we do want checkbox medicine for.
Absolutely.
If we're doing surgery, we want to check that if you used 5 sponges and whatever other instruments, that at the end, you still have those.
Right. And the same is true when you're admitting a patient with, let's say, new or recurrent heart failure.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of things you want to go through to make sure that the patient has been offered a ACE inhibitor, has been offered a beta blocker, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're titrating Lasix, and you know the GFR or the creatinine and all of those kind of things. They're essential to, and making sure you don't miss things, the whole checklist manifesto thing.
Oh yeah. Cause I mean, it's so easy to miss things. You mean, because we're working with humans. And like we said earlier, it's not about randomized controlled trials. They inform us, but there's so many other types of studies that we can use, cohorts or even case control studies and so on that can answer specific questions.
It was a case study that determined, it was case studies and case series that identified thalidomide originally.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure. And cohort studies for smoking.
Right.
Yeah. So some of the other things that we said, it's not about necessarily being able to influence outcomes. Hopefully you can. We also, in the article we talk about, it's not something new. I mean, the concept of using evidence in practice is not new. I think most people thought we did it before, but it's more evidence-based practice is now putting it at the front of your thought process, if you will, about how to practice. And some people, when you talk about evidence-based practice, they say, well, you know, we just ignore basic science. And I think sometimes we should, but only if it confuses everything. Because we've talked about this before. It's really nice to know how it works, but I'd really like to know if it works first off.
Yeah, I understand where that comes from, in the sense that those are particularly people doing basic science research.
Oh, it's really important.
And that stuff's very important, and it lays the groundwork that helps us understand physiology and all of those things much better, and allows us hopefully to develop better treatments in the future.
Yeah.
But as far as informing day-to-day practice, it's just there's little to no relevance, and nor should there be. As you said, the question should always be, does it work, not how it works. The how it works is interesting, but it's not vital.
And we've screwed up on how it works a whole so many times, it's not funny, but
I know. Absolutely.
And then, you know, some people say, well, you know, with evidence-based practice, you're just trying to save money. And you know, as if it's kind of a bad thing. But, you know, the purpose is not to save money. But as you know, the few studies that have looked at it, if you do actually do evidence-based practice, it does end up saving money. But it's not about rationing and all that sort of stuff. It's about using the best available evidence.
And I would say, if you're an evidence-based practitioner right now, you'd have to be choosing diabetic therapies that are more expensive.
Yeah, for sure.
And that, like, if you're, and there will be some out there who will run down those studies and therefore devalue those therapies. But the fact is if you're looking at the best available evidence right now, apart from metformin, and we've debated that before, for second and third line is probably the, the Gliflozins and the glutides.
Yeah.
So they're, GLP-1s, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they still marginally do much at all, but
they don't do much, but they do more than what we can tell sulfonylureas do.
And then the final thing that evidence-based practice is, it's not about getting rid of all competing interests, because that is, I don't know if you know this, Mike, that's impossible.
Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of interests that even if we took never a cent from industry, there's still interests we have.
Oh, yeah.
The way you write, what you've written before, it's hard to change your mind. Your mind, but hard to change our minds, right? About, when new evidence comes.
And then trying to get tenure.
Yeah.
and wanting to be known, to be, an expert in an area, all those sorts of things is really, really interesting. And so the final comment that we made about evidence-based practice is really simply doing the right thing in the right way. Now, I know that sounds like, motherhood and apple pie and all that sort of stuff, but it sort of frames where we were coming from with this evidence-based practice. And as I mentioned to you earlier, one could argue that you could make outcomes worse. And the example that we used is, let's pretend, and I don't know if you have to pretend, but pretend statins do work in primary prevention. I don't think we need to pretend because I think the evidence is pretty clear.
Yeah.
So let's say if you gave it to primary prevention people for 5 years, you might reduce heart attacks and strokes by 1 or 2% in an absolute number. So let's say we did a study where we randomized people to either we told them you should take it or must take it, or you said, here are the pros and cons of it, and it's up to you to decide. Your experience, I'm sure you'd agree with me, and sort of certainly my experience, is when you mentioned sort of 1 or 2% benefit and then the cost and the potential side effects, I don't know about you, Mike, but not everyone wants that.
Very few people choose it, right? And they'll choose lifestyle, which again, the majority won't actually do, but they'll, in your office, they'll choose lifestyle interventions like the Mediterranean diet or increasing their activity. And for those of us in practice, it's a sad statement, but very rarely do those transformations actually take place. But still, they're making a choice, right? And they're choosing, they don't want to take these products for the benefit that they'll get.
Yeah. So. And so you could argue if you did an RCT of those two different arms where we said, okay, you should take this and really pushed it and got more people on them. And then you did the values and preferences side, less people would take it. If the statins work and everything else being equal, you would have more heart attacks and strokes in the group that got evidence-based practice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And some have suggested that's occurring. I remember, in New Zealand, when they started to promote shared decision making, they were concerned that there would be more heart attacks because people were refusing interventions, particularly in the moderate risk range.
And so that
is going to happen, but those are patients' choices. If you want to be prescriptive and dogmatic, we would need to put it in the water.
Yeah, no, exactly. And some people have said, there was an article just recently there that they suggested we just put it in the water. And that is tricky at best. And I'm pretty sure we should just, you know what should be in water?
Water.
Yeah. So that does get, that gets very tricky. But we just wanted to use that as an example to say there is no evidence-based practice is not supposed to improve outcomes. Hopefully it doesn't kill everybody. That's not what the outcome. But there's no reason why it necessarily has to. And so our argument was, why not have the only outcome be of matter is that you've explained the benefits and harms of treatments, and the checkbox, if you will, is discuss with patients the benefits and harms, and they decided or did not decide to take therapy, and I'm going to support that. I think that would not be an unreasonable checkbox. And I know there are in the States a lot of people talking about, can we add that checkbox into the medical, electronic medical records?
Pay for performance and that kind of thing. That's the problem, right? Is when we talk about pay for performance, we're often measured on on things that are easily counted. So did you get a lipid level every single year? Did you get an A1C every 3 months? Did you, you know, is this patient on statins, is et cetera? And so those things, which are, they're easy to measure, they're dichotomous and all of that kind of thing, but they're not, they don't address the underlying real question that we have is, did a patient get a discussion? At least at some level about the risks and benefits of therapy.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so I'm sure as people are listening to this podcast, in a lot of people going, yeah, but there's lots of exceptions to what we're talking about, to what you guys are talking about. And absolutely. And that's why we brought some of them up in our article. Because you can, of course, come up with that, you know, a shared decision is not the outcome for everything in medicine. We talked about a few examples, and I think these are legitimate ones because, you know, we have laws that prevent harm from occurring where, you know, mental incapacity or really strong personal beliefs or religious beliefs, you know, for instance, like Jehovah Witnesses' refusal to transfuse blood to those in dire need of it is an example. Mm-hmm. And we bypass that values and preferences sometimes, although even that is tricky. I think you probably agree with that as well.
It can be very tricky.
Yeah. And there's, you know, the few circumstances where a shared decision making is not possible. I mean, if you get hit by a bus and you're unconscious, you can't really do shared decision making, and you may not even need to in that case. But or also, you know, things like psychiatrically unstable patients, as an example, who might be going to harm themselves or others. We take away people's ability to do shared decision making in those types of examples.
And would take away their people with a very high risk communicable disease, right? We'll take away, at times we have taken away people's rights in those cases as well, for the rights of the population.
Yeah. And also, I mean, even examples of smoking bans. I mean, well, someone can say, well, no, you know, it's a person's choice. They should be allowed to smoke. And I think most people say, yeah, go ahead. But if it affects other people,
right,
then it's tricky. Now, one of the areas that is somewhat tricky is vaccines, because, you know, there is the possibility that while you do take vaccines for your personal benefit, it may lead to a reduction in a transmissible disease for other people. Right. That is not always the case, but it certainly can be. Mm-hmm. You know, with things like influenza or HPV and so on.
Yeah, the consideration for herd immunity.
Yeah, exactly.
And just even transmissibility, as you said, with HPV vaccine, if you've been immunized, all of a sudden you become less of a risk to transmit it, those kind of things.
Yeah. So those are some sort of examples where I think our premise that it should always be a shared decision as the outcome are a little bit trickier, but it doesn't take away or detract from the central tenet of what we're talking about. I don't believe it does anyway. And then, as you're fully aware of this, it is not unusual that, you know, a lot of times a patient will just say, well, what would you do? And that's okay. You know, to say, you know, what would you do? And I know you have cases where you've actually made decisions for people.
Yeah, well, yeah, you try not to these cases, but sometimes you can incur. I think all of us regularly encourage patients in one direction or another. Mm-hmm. But to full on make decisions, I guess it depends on what level that is. Sometimes you make decisions, for example, they're rare, but it does happen in medicine, where you take away, as you said, with psychiatric patients, mm-hmm. or take away children from families, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Those are not easy decisions, we do those kind of things, with a lot of regret, or take away the ability of someone to drive or that kind of thing. But
but even sometimes, you know, let's say it was, you know, a person wasn't sure about whether or not they wanted to do anticoagulation or whatever. And then they asked, well, what would you do? I'll do what you would suggest.
Yeah. So those kind of things were, it's more than, like, the other ones are more, maybe even, well, they're dogmatic and draconian and all of those kind of things, maybe. But what you're talking about is something where someone has abdicated their responsibility to make the decision to you because they trust and believe you'll make the best choice for them. Those are a little different, right? Those are, that's when you're still, I think, reaching a shared decision. The shared decision in that case is to go with what you want. With,
yeah, exactly.
Go with what the doctor
yeah, exactly.
or
yeah, yeah.
pharmacist or yeah, yeah, healthcare yeah. provider would recommend. It's still a shared decision. You've given them some options. Some patients won't even want to hear the options, the idea. So just tell me what you think I should do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know.
And that's fine, too. They're allowed to make that decision as well, but that's a decision.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, exactly. And then there's a final one, and then we don't actually talk about it in, well, actually, there's two final ones. Antibiotics are tricky because, you know, if you said, you know, here's, if the benefit was very, very small, relatively speaking, you know, shortens the duration of treatment by 8 hours or whatever. And, you know, some people would argue, well, we just shouldn't, you know, you need to be sort of the gatekeeper of all antibiotics. And you know, as well as I know, that that's difficult sometimes because people get mad at you.
Yeah, so I've said this before, I think, on the podcast. Yeah. One of the most angry patients I've ever had was someone with a cold who I refused antibiotics to.
Yeah.
They leapt off the table and they were screaming at me. And I remember they were screaming so vigorously that there was a lot of spittle coming out.
Yeah.
And it was hitting me on the face as I stood there kind of cornered. And all I could think to myself is, I'm going to get your damn cold.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'm going to want antibiotics.
Yeah. And so you wrote him a prescription for erythromycin 1 gram every 2 hours.
Yes. Clindamycin, I'll show you.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. No, they left very, very displeased with me.
Yeah.
And I'm sure went to the very next clinic.
Yeah. So those are tricky. And then the final one, and this is there's been I listened to a very good book on this, and I'm blanking on it. I think it was called Critical Decision Making or something. Anyway, about the end of life decisions. And the argument there was that obviously, you know, family members need to be involved, but it is very comforting, if you will, if a healthcare provider, you know, in most cases would be a physician, would to say, you know, I think it's time. I think it's the right thing to do. And so it's not, it's sort of they are making a decision, if you will, so that the guilt is not on the family members to say, yeah, it was us that pulled the plug. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You support people in those decisions. Again,
yeah.
It's the art of medicine, right? So
yeah.
this is a thing everybody talks about. Evidence-based medicine is this science dictating what we should do. But actually, the application of it is still riddled with a nuance of the kind of art that we have. Like, how do we help patients make those decisions that are best for them where there is a direction that seems relatively clear?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about, you know, your risk is 12%. Do you want to take a statin?
Yeah.
God knows what's right for that person.
Yeah.
Only that person knows. But when we're talking about someone who's been suffering and letting their dad go and that kind of thing, it's quite reasonable to let them know that, you know, this is the options ahead of them, like conscious sedation sedation is a reasonable path and all of those kind of things. And I think that's our job. That's
yeah.
our job to help patients understand those things and come to terms with their decisions.
And so if you go down this pathway of making shared decision the key outcome for evidence-based practice, it's not, you know, as well as that, it's not as easy as that. I mean, this is not simple stuff. As we say in our article, it really takes care and kindness to make sure patients are supported to become well-informed and confident enough to voice their personal preferences. And, you know, that sort of partnership is tricky, as we've the word that we use for everything when we don't know what to do. There's a lot of value to it. I think you get a lot of value as a healthcare provider if you do that. But it requires sort of a different attitude, if you will.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. It's an approach where you have to accept that it's going to take you a little more time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to. You can trim it, you can do all sorts of things, but you're going to spend more time if you really want to do that.
And I'm not naive to think that everybody would agree with this sort of thought process, because I think a lot of clinicians really are that they should always be recommending treatments proven to improve population-based outcomes.
Yeah, there are some who believe that. They
yeah.
end up on guideline committees frequently.
Oh, Michael, you're so mean to everybody, including me. And then, of course, you get, you know, the argument about, you know, if you don't do it, you'll get sued and legal resources and all that sort of stuff. But You know, it's and when we also run into the problems, as you know, with pay for performance issues, getting blood pressures down and glucoses down. Until that changes, I don't think we're going to see a big change in shared decision making, because it there's no incentive to do it. It costs you money. People get annoyed at you. Mm-hmm. And so on. So it's not without peril going down this pathway. But I think we tried to suggest that it's the right thing to do.
Yes, and I think, as you were mentioning early in the podcast, there is been talk for at least a decade now about, it feels like a decade, that if we're going to measure performance, what we should be measuring is shared decision making. Mm-hmm. And so there should be that tick box. And sure, you can game that. Game that. But at least that's a start, right? Yeah. It's a start in the right direction.
Yeah. But you can game anything. I mean, I've heard people do, you know, we're just going to keep measuring your glucose. And once it's normal, we'll never measure it again. Because nothing good can come from measuring it again. That sort of stuff. So, you know, so that's the premise of the article that we wrote. And I think one can make a pretty strong argument that the vast majority of circumstances in medicine, the only outcome of relevance for evidence-based practice is whether a shared decision was made. At least that's our final endpoint of the sort of concept.
Yeah.
Of the premise. So mm-hmm. if this is of, hopefully this has been an interesting podcast for you guys to listen to. I do want to once again thank Glenn for all of the work that he did on this article. I think, you know, we came up with a pretty cogent argument, and we tried to come up with all the exceptions to the rule and so on. And I just thought it'd be a useful discussion. And I know it's actually useful having you there, Mike, to talk about sort of your experience. And having not been one of the authors on the paper, I think it's just an interesting discussion to have, if you will.
Well, I think you were looking for someone intelligent to co-author the article with.
Yeah, and then they weren't available. Oh, you said co-author it. I thought you meant do it on the podcast. No.
Yeah.
No. Glenn is way smarter and much better writer than I am, even though I put my name first.
Surprise! I've worked with you too. I know the story. I know the drill.
Oh, I don't know. I think the last few papers we've written, I've been author 7, but that actually is more than I deserved for the work I did. But yeah, so we're not going to go anywhere further with this podcast, because now we're just insulting each other. And so I don't think we don't need to sell anything at this moment. We hope this discussion was useful. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, that is all good, James. I will mention the PIPE conference is coming up. It is, oh my goodness, sorry, 19 and 20 October. You think I'd know that?
You'd have thought so.
But it has a lot of good content again this year, so please check it out. You'll soon be getting emails and such about the upcoming conference.
Excellent. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.